Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Tuesday, January 18th. I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn, and I'm here with our U.S. correspondent, Jacob Magid, reporting from Colleyville, Texas, as well as our environment reporter, Sue Sirks from Jerusalem. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
We have a lot to discuss, including new Israeli efforts to protect trees for Tu Bishvat, the new year of the trees, which was observed yesterday. Also, a water purifier called Miriam's Well, which is a potential game changer for developing countries. First, we'll start with Jacob. We are going to discuss the continuing developments of this attack that took place on Saturday, January 15th, in which there was an 11-hour hostage standoff in a Colleyville Reform synagogue. Jacob, the question that every Jew in the world and many people are asking is this or is it not considered an anti-Semitic attack?
Well, Amanda, it really depends on who you ask, because right after the last hostages managed to escape on Saturday night, Special Agent Matthew DeSarno told reporters that the FBI believes that from its engagement with the subject, that he was singularly focused on one issue, the release of this Pakistani prisoner that was sitting behind bars some 15 miles away from Colleyville. And he said it was not related to anything related to the Jewish community. Joe Biden, on the other hand, said the next day that it was not the case and that actually there were multiple reasons. And he talked about it being an act of terror. And he said the hostage holder used anti-Semitic and anti-Israel rhetoric, indicating that this was an anti-Semitic attack. Now, again, on the one hand, though, we had in the Reform movement, we had Union for Reform Judaism leader Rabbi Rick Jacobs echo basically Biden's sentiment and say that this was clearly an anti-Semitic attack. The hostage taker, Malik Faisal Akram, chose a synagogue. He didn't choose some random McDonald's, as Rick Jacobs said. And there's no other way to interpret this than besides understanding that it was anti-Semitism. On the other hand, we had the president of Congregation Beth Israel come out with a statement in tandem with Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker, who's the rabbi who was inside as the hostage crisis unfolded. The president of his synagogue said that this was a random act of violence, basically completely negating what Rick Jacobs, the head of the movement, was saying. So basically, it seems to be a matter of interpretation. However, I think there was a little bit more clarity that came out on Monday, when at least I interviewed Jeff Cohn, who was another one of the hostages, along with Rabbi Charlie. And he said that the attacker, Faisal Akram, told him that he did not come to kill Jews. He came to try to release this Pakistani prisoner. However, he said that he brought with him an extremely dangerous ideology that bought anti-Semitic tropes, that Jews controlled everything, that Jews that in the synagogue would be able to just call up Joe Biden and basically bring about the release of this Pakistani prisoner who he was calling his sister. So on the one hand, it was a random decision that this attacker chose. Cohen said that Akram told him that he had picked a synagogue, not because he wanted to use the power, quote unquote, of Jews. And he picked a synagogue in Colleyville because it was the closest synagogue to the prison where the Pakistani prisoner known as Lady Al-Qaeda is being housed.
Okay, that is a lot of hands that you just brought up and a lot of however. So essentially, we don't yet know definitively if it was an anti-Semitic attack or not. But what it sounds like what you're saying is that the perpetrator had this anti-Semitic ideology and knowingly chose a synagogue because he felt that Jews ruled the world and that Jews could put pressure to free this prisoner, which is in itself one of the oldest tropes in the world.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think what Jeff Cohn was doing was kind of putting to bed the debate that was between Rick Jacobs and the president of the synagogue or between Joe Biden and the FBI, that he kind of fell in the middle, explaining that, yes, there's reasons to assume maybe that it wasn't like anti-Semitic, But at the end of the day, the tropes behind it were.
He is not targeting Jews per se in order to perpetrate violence against Jews, but in order to pressure the government, because obviously Jews have the ear of the president.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about what you're finding in terms of the residents in the town. It sounds like they also believe that the synagogue was randomly chosen. Based on what?
Yeah, I pushed this question because it was quite surprising over and over again hearing from over, I think, around 24 folks that I spoke to in the immediate area around the, about like within a quarter of a mile radius along Colleyville, who really believe that because there's so much craziness in the world and there's all this evil, I guess the kind of one person said, that it could happen. It could have, any hostage taker could have found an excuse to shoot, to take a church hostage just as much of a reason that a hostage taker could have that chose to take the synagogue hostage. And they very much stood in solidarity with the synagogue. So there's a lot of goodwill there. And not to say that their belief that this wasn't an anti, that the synagogue wasn't purposely targeted isn't legitimate, but they definitely do not see what happened on Saturday in the same light that many Jewish organizations and members of the community see it.
For Israelis, anything that happens to Jews around the diaspora is local news. And I assume that the same is the case in the United States as well. Jacob, thank you so much. You've been working very long days and we really appreciate your reporting from the scene. Thank you again.
Thanks, Amanda.
We'll go to a short break now.
Hey, it's Jessica Steinberg. If you have an important message you'd like to share with people who care deeply about Israel and the Jewish world, there's really no better way to do that than by advertising in our podcasts. Reach the Times Visual's unique community with an audio ad. For more information, email ads@timesofisrael.com. That's ads@timesofisrael.com.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Sue, did you catch the beautiful full moon for Tu Bishvat?
No, I was probably too busy working.
Okay, so tell us about the bill proposed yesterday by Chaver Knesset, member of Knesset Alon Tal, to replace legislation that was created, what, under the British mandate in 1926?
Yes, and it's hardly been changed since then. So Alon Tal, who's known to many English speakers, is an environmental policy expert. He also used to chair a forestry committee on the JNF's international board, and he set himself the target of passing three laws, actually, in his first year. This law, as you say, is an update on the 1926 British Mandate Law. That law, of course, didn't take account of all sorts of things that are important today: biodiversity, ecological corridors, planning for climate change, lots and lots of different issues. So he's updating the law, or trying to update the law, but he's also trying to make it kind of better organized and more forceful. So at the core of the law is setting up a forestry and tree planting council, which will have a broad membership, including the public, and would set policy. And then having the JNF implement those programs, which the council will approve and also budget. But I think some of the important parts of the act are, first of all, that it gives the authorities far more teeth to act against offenders. There's actually a possibility of jailing people for up to 3 years for really serious offences. It also gives the public a lot more say. You know, there are many things that annoy people locally, but one of the top things is cutting down trees. People hate having trees cut down, and often people have their favourite trees. So one of his proposals is actually to alert people to proposals to cut down trees by putting signs on them, which doesn't happen today, in much the way that planning proposals are put out there for the public so they can react. And also making the process far, far easier for people to protest to the authorities when there's a proposal to cut down a tree. And the third thing, which is really interesting, is he wants cities to set targets to cover something like 40% of their surface area with trees, which is really interesting because, you know, people often don't realise how important trees are. They're not only important to give us shade, they really do regulate temperature, but they're important for keeping water in the ground, for preventing flooding and erosion, for giving us oxygen. A million different reasons why trees have to be preserved, and many, many more have to be planted. Of course, when you cut down a mature tree, it's not something that can be easily replaced because a sapling can take 30, 40 years to grow. So it's really important to preserve what we've got. And that's one of the things that the law tries to do.
One of the points that I noted in your article is the preservation of our historic trees. Here in Israel, we have several trees that are 1,000 years old, even 2,000 years old. I thought that was noteworthy.
We do. And in fact, interestingly, one of the reasons that these huge trees haven't been harmed over the years is that they were regarded throughout history as holy. So, for example, if you take the name Alon, which is the word for an oak tree, it has the word El in it, God. It's the same with the Elah, which is the pistachio. It has the word God in it. Those trees are amongst the biggest that grow wild in Israel, and people used to worship them, which is why you often see them in cemeteries as well. So they weren't touched. That's why they were allowed to get to such grand dimensions.
Of course, the mix of the holy and the mundane, as usual. Now, let's talk about a case that you're reporting on today about uranium finds in Nahal Tzin in the Zin stream that one professor says can just be washed away with soap and water. What is this about?
Yeah, so this is an ongoing story. Basically, ICL has a subsidiary. The Israel Chemicals Limited, which is a big consortium, has a subsidiary called Rotem Amphor Chemicals. And what they do is they mine phosphates in the Negev Desert. And the waste product is called phosphogypsum. It's hard to say quickly. That is radioactive. Now, what they do is they store it in pools. But this phosphogypsum, it's not only radioactive and polluting, it's very acidic, which means that if the floor of the evaporation pool isn't really properly sealed, it will just burn through the limestone rock and eventually make its way to the groundwater, which supplies springs, which supplies streams. So there's actually three efforts at the moment to launch class action suits in different streams that are in the vicinity of the mines and the production plants. And this one is concerns the Zin River, which has turned yellow and is foamy and smells dreadful. And there's a class action suit now for 3 billion shekels to put it right. Today, there's a meeting at the Be'er Sheva District Court to discuss an opinion that's been submitted by ICL by a doctor, a medical doctor, a pharmacologist, who says, well, you know, the water may be a bit radioactive, but it doesn't really harm because if you swallow it, it'll come out in the urine within a few days. And if it gets onto your skin, just wash it off with soap and water. So he says that it's not dangerous to public health at all. But I have to tell you that if I was anywhere near, I would not go into that stream.
I have to say the words a bit radioactive just kind of give me chills and make me want to shudder. Okay, now something that could be a potential game changer in the developing world is a product that is called Miriam's Well. First of all, what is this name? Why did they choose this name?
Miriam's Well comes from the Bible. It was a source of water that accompanied the Jews during their years of wandering in the desert. So it's a rather nice name to choose because there's something miraculous about it as well. The issue is that in much of Africa, much of the developing world, people do not yet still have access to clean drinking water. And so what they'll often do, and it's a very common sight in Africa, is take a jerry can, walk miles and miles, it's usually the women and the children, find some body of water which you know, is probably full of animal feces, if not worse things, fill up the jerry can and schlep it home again. And so there's a lot of disease, obviously, associated with polluted water. The Miriam's Well, it's a bit like what in Israel we know as the Tami Alba. It's a unit which in many homes you'll see, which is connected to the water system and purifies what's coming out, basically, at the press of a button. The Miriam's Well is slightly different because, first of all, it's geared at different pollutants, but the pipe will go into the jerry can. In other words, in a home, you'll bring your jerry can home, you'll put the pipe that connects it to the Miriam's Well, you'll press a button, and out will come clean drinking water. Now, they're looking at hundreds of millions of potential homes, and in terms of pricing, they're hoping to sell it at cost through non-profit organizations, because obviously, you know, your average village home in Africa probably won't be able to afford very much money. They're now looking for $1 million to polish off the prototype and start the first series. And so if anybody is interested, Miriam's Well, look it up. The company is called Alum All, and in fact, its chief technological officer used to work for Tami Alba. So that kind of closes the circle.
It should also be noted that not only do these villages not have running water, they don't have electricity. And this Miriam's Well is based on solar energy technology.
Very important point, which I forgot to mention. Absolutely. It's based on solar energy. Critical point.
Happy to shed light on that. But thank you very much for joining me today. It was a pleasure.
And for me. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.